right. Our fourth case for argument this morning is Bernardo de la Cruz versus Garland. Mr. Rubenstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm here this morning, as you say, on behalf of petitioner David Bernardo de la Cruz. Mr. Bernardo has lived in this country for approximately 2 decades. Thank you. During that time, is that better, Your Honor? During that time, he has been, as the immigration judge found, and as the government does not contest, a person of good moral character. The agency proceedings through which the government has nonetheless attempted to remove Mr. Bernardo from this country were fundamentally flawed in several respects, and I'd like to begin with the Appointments Clause challenge. So, as we explained in our reply brief, that argument proceeds in 3 steps, only the last of which the government actually contests. The first step is, of course, that inferior officers may be appointed only by the president, the courts of law, or the head of a department. That's right there in the Constitution. No dispute as to that. Second step in the argument is that temporary board members like Mr. Gonzalez in this case qualify as inferior officers for purposes of the Appointments Clause. The court doesn't have to address that on the merits either because the government has forfeited any argument to the contrary. That brings us then to the crux of the case. Was Mr. Gonzalez validly appointed by the Attorney General? And the government argues that he was because of the appointment papers submitted with their brief, under which Acting Attorney General Rosen purported to appoint Mr. Gonzalez as a temporary board member. The problem for the government is that in order to validly appoint for purposes of the Appointments Clause, there has to be statutory or regulatory authority to carry out the appointment, and there is no such authority in this case. Now, the government has pointed to a couple of different provisions of the regulations implementing the Immigration and Nationality Act, under which it says that the Attorney General had such authority. Neither of those works. The first is 8 CFR section 1003.1A1 that deals with ordinary board members. The other is A4 dealing with temporary board members. I'd like to just quickly talk about A1. Here, the government made no argument under A1 in its opening brief. So again, that's forfeited. Even if it weren't, the decision of the Fifth Circuit in its unpublished Mboba opinion is respectfully incorrect. That decision failed to recognize the distinctions between temporary board members under A4 and ordinary board members under A1. Specifically,
isn't it clear here that the acting attorney general appointed the temporary board member in 2021 based on the submission by the government?
So the acting attorney general, Mr. Rosen, did purport to appoint Mr. Gonzalez in 2021 as per that appendix. However, he lacked regulatory authority to do so. And under the Supreme Court's decision in Muat, if there is no statutory or regulatory authority for the head of the department to act, that doesn't count for purposes of the Appointments Clause. So it's still an Appointments Clause issue. And the reason that there's no...
There's a difference, though, in the regulation. I mean, you rely upon the regulation and the difference between A1 and... A4, right? Temporary board member.
Correct.
A4 says the director may, in his discretion, designate immigration judges, whereas A1 states that the board member shall be attorney appointed by the attorney general. So doesn't that lead to the conclusion that appointing someone and designating someone are two different things? And so here the government argues that designate recommend, right, and appoint simply.
So I don't think that could be squared with the language of A4, Your Honor, because while it does say designate rather than appoint, the object of the designation is, I'm quoting now, to act as a temporary board member. It's not a designation for review by the Attorney General. It's not a designation for consideration as to whether this is a good person to appoint or not.
But if the regulation was intending for designation to be the same as appoint, wouldn't they just use the same word, appoint? I mean, given the fact that it's two different typical statutory construction, two different words mean two different things in the same statute, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but there's actually a strong exclusio inference then that the Attorney General doesn't have any role in A4. As you note, under A1, the Attorney General is specifically given the authority to appoint. That would be unnecessary if just based on the existence of regulation, he had such authority anyway. On the government's reading, the Attorney General has the authority to appoint under A4 without any explicit conferral of that authority. That doesn't make sense in light of A1, where just such an explicit conferral of authority is given. And then there's a second exclusio inference to be drawn in A4, from the specific reference to two other officials, the EOIR director and the deputy attorney general, whereas the attorney general is entirely absent from that provision. So I think when you combine those two exclusio inferences and you look to the discretion, which is another factor in under A4, the discretion it gives the EOIR director to designate shows that it is his personal opinion, his personal judgment, who the right person to name in Lucia's language is. But Your Honors, even if you didn't agree with that, even if you thought that the Attorney General had a valid role to play under A4, if you accepted the government's reading of the regulation in full, that wouldn't cure the Appointments Clause issue here. They would simply run into a different Appointments Clause issue, and that's the one flagged by Myers in the Supreme Court almost a century ago. And what Myers says is that one who lacks the constitutional authority to appoint, like Congress in Myers or like the EOIR director here, also cannot impose restrictions that amount to designation. Myers says you can't designate. That's the very word it uses to describe what one without authority cannot do. It's also the word that A4 uses to describe what the EOIR director is actually doing. So under Myers, there's an Appointments Clause problem whether or not the government's reading of the regulation is correct. The executive branch itself has recognized that. All the way back in 1871, Attorney General Ackerman recognized that a statutory scheme under which the Civil Service Commission would tell the heads of departments who to appoint would be invalid because it would make the Civil Service Commission, which, like Congress in Myers and like the EOIR director here, lacks constitutional authority to appoint, they would nonetheless effectively be the appointing entity. That can't be. More recently, OLC has recognized in the context of the statute governing appointment of the U.S. Trade Representative that a restriction placed on one with appointing authority that limits their scope of discretion such that many of those best qualified are no longer eligible cannot stand under the Appointments Clause. That's the executive branch's own theory. Here, A4, even on the government's reading, goes much farther than that. It precludes the Attorney General from appointing not only many of those most qualified to serve as temporary board members, but every last person who is best qualified except for the one that the EOIR director happens to designate, and in some cases, the Deputy Attorney General happens to approve. As a result, it simply can't be the case that the Attorney General has been restricted to a role that's more akin to the Senate's role in principal officers of merely evaluating candidates that have been named in Lucia's language or designated in...
That line of cases, those are separation of powers cases. We don't have that problem here. These are executive branch regulations promulgated by the Attorney General himself, who has plenary authority to establish the procedures by which these removal proceedings are held.
So
the Attorney General can change the regulations anytime he wants to.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Attorney General can change the regulations anytime he or she wants to. The Attorney General could, in all likelihood, promulgate a regulation saying the Attorney General shall appoint temporary board members, but he hasn't done so here. And if you look at the appointment papers that the government submitted, he purports to appoint Mr. Gonzalez, quote, as described in 8 CFR section 1003.1A4. And as 1003.1A4 currently reads, that makes the designation of the EOIR director an absolute prerequisite to his authority to appoint. And the Attorney General, while he may be able to change the regulations, is bound by the regulations as they currently exist. That's the Supreme Court's decision in Accardi, where the Board of Immigration Appeals was considering a cancellation decision, and the Attorney General essentially put out a list of people who would not be eligible for cancellation. Now, even though the Attorney General was going to have ultimate review authority over the decision, the regulations gave the Board of Immigration Appeals discretion to assess whether the applicant would be eligible for that relief in the first instance. When the Attorney General overrode that discretion with his list of people who were not allowed, that violated the regulations as they exist, and that was why the decision had to be vacated and sent back. Similarly here, although the Attorney General might have promulgated a regulation allowing him to do what he purported to do, that regulation is not on the books. There's, as a result, an Appointments Clause problem. And as a result, we would ask that you vacate and remand on that
basis.
The Attorney
General is the head of the department.
The Attorney General is the head of the department,
yes. Has plenary authority to make appointments.
The Attorney General under Muat only has plenary authority to make appointments as authorized by a statute or regulation. And there
and is... the statute authorizes him to appoint anybody and to appoint the officers within the system that he himself controls and sets the procedures for. So again, there's no separation of powers problem here. The head of the department is in complete control of this process.
Well, the statute authorizes him to promulgate regulations governing the procedures, and he is then bound under Accardi by the regulations he has promulgated. But Your Honor, even if you don't think that there's an appointments clause problem, there's still a failure to comply with the regulations as they exist. And the failure to comply with the regulations as they exist is itself a basis to vacate and remand, as the government's own case, Medina Carrion, makes
clear. Yeah, but that's a separate argument from the constitutional argument.
It's a separate but related, but I think they get you to the same place. Either one results in a requirement to vacate and remand for further consideration. So just a quick minute on the merits of the case. Even if you don't agree with the appointments clause and the ultra vires argument, the immigration judge erred in two fundamental legal respects. The first is that he failed to follow binding board precedent when he failed to find where Mr. Bernardo's children would live, but more importantly, carry out the analysis required under cases like Cabrera-Alvarez to assess the emotional and assess the financial harm that would flow from that.
The issue of where the children were going to live was never disputed. The record below was clear that they were going to stay in the U.S. and not go to Mexico.
That's correct, Your Honor, but if you look at the entirety of the immigration judge's decision, particularly the analysis section, there's no acknowledgement of where the children will go. The only two cases that he cites are cases in which the children of the removed non-citizen would accompany them overseas. He doesn't carry out the analysis of how will
Given Mr. that there's no dispute, why wouldn't it be harmless in essence?
Well, I think that it's not just the lack of the magic words, I hereby find the children are going to remain in the country. It's the failure to conduct the analysis that necessitates under cases like In re Monreal and Cabrera-Alvarez. And that I see that I'm about to enter my rebuttal time, reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you. Ms. Dunn.
May it please the court, Lindsay Dunn on behalf of the respondent, Merrick Garland. Unfortunately, in this case, Mr. Bernardo de la Cruz did not meet his statutory burden of establishing eligibility for relief before the agency. But that doesn't translate necessarily into agency error. And here, the agency did not violate the Constitution or otherwise commit legal error in denying Mr. Bernardo de la Cruz's claim. And the arguments to the contrary are insufficiently tethered to either the facts of this case or the law as it's currently applied in this circuit and the various sister circuits. I'll start with the appointments clause issue because that's at the heart of this case. The government does not contest that the temporary board members at issue, and specifically Mr. Gonzalez, is an inferior officer requiring appointment by head of the department. But the government does note that the Mboba case came out after the government filed its brief. The government did file a 28J about that case, and petitioner had the opportunity to rely on that case in its reply brief. The analysis in Mboba does go further than the government. So the government, in its response brief, distinguished between designation and appointment as two separate things that could happen within the same statutory, or pardon me, within the same regulatory scheme. And Mboba goes farther at looking at that, pardon me, provision in A and saying A1 says that the Attorney General has the authority to appoint board members. A4, which is within the same section, refers to temporary board members and specifically their designation by the ER director and with respect to those in the situation like Mr. Gonzalez, who's at issue here, the temporary board member who issued this decision, the approval of the deputy attorney general. But this is all within the same section of the same regulation, A1 and A4, that these provisions can be read in concert with each other. The temporary board members are indeed board members. And so that provision at A1 covers their appointment. And that also makes sense when one looks at what actually happens. The government filed these supplemental papers showing the appointment happened by the acting attorney general at the time.
And it was after a designation by the director from the approval, correct?
Yes. And I want to take a moment to discuss the issue that was brought up with respect to the role of the Deputy Attorney General, because we can't just look at these provisions in a vacuum. So the Deputy Attorney General under 28 CFR 0.15 has the power authorized to execute the power of the Attorney General, quote, unless such power or authority is required by law to be exercised by the Attorney General personally. So when we read those sections in concert and also consider that his role here is approval, not appointment, and that it's within the same section, all of this works in concert, particularly when you consider that under 28 CFR 0.15, much of the Deputy Attorney General's responsibility does relate to appointment and employment matters. But here, if he cannot by law actually do the appointment, then these provisions work together and make sense that it is actually under A1 that the board members have to be appointed. Also, I asked the court to look at the provision, the regulation as a whole, because there are instances where the regulation does make a distinction between board members generally, and that would include the temporary board members, and specifically permanent board members. And all of those provisions relate to voting and en banc. And I'll point the court specifically to 8 CFR 1003.185. That relates to the en banc process. So the temporary board members come, they have the full authority of board members, but they don't participate in that process. And then the other reference to permanent board members is at 8 CFR section 1.003.1G3. That again relates to designation of precedence. This all, when one reads the regulation as a whole, makes sense. So there are board members, and that's part of the 23 who are critical for the voting and the en banc process. And every provision related to specifically voting also specifies that that's those permanent board members. Then there's only one provision that specifies different conditions for temporary board members, and that is just at A4, talking about how the different process for, by which they are chosen. And even the wording makes sense because, as was pointed out, this is a different situation than what's being discussed in Myers, where you have a separation of powers issue. EOIR is a creation of regulation. Congress gave the Attorney General authority to create EOIR by regulation. And under regulation, the Attorney General not only creates EOIR, but also creates the provision creating the director's role. The Attorney General actually appoints the director. So all of this is within the purview of the Attorney General. He's creating the regulations. He's also here creating the terms of the pool. And specifically with respect to Mr. Gonzalez, it's an attorney who's worked at EOIR for over 10 years, that those are the qualifications, who then is chosen by the EOIR director or identified by him. This all makes perfect sense with the approval of the Deputy Attorney General, and then finally with the actual appointment by the Attorney General. Again, when read as a whole, all of these provisions make sense together. And it is quite different from the cases that counsel for petitioner raised in his reply brief upon seeing these paper, upon seeing the supplemental appendix, because again, all of those relate to separation of powers. And one can't treat the EOIR director as though he is the same as Congress. It's just not the same issue. He is under the purview of the head of the department, the Attorney General. I also do want to clarify another point that came up in the reply brief with respect to, in this case, the alleged lack of involvement by the Deputy Attorney General. So here, Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen appointed Gabriel Gonzalez, the temporary board member who heard this case. But at the time of the appointment, the acting attorney general was actually the deputy attorney general. There was no attorney general. And then so under 28 USC section 508, in the case of a vacancy in the office of the attorney general or of his absence or disability, the deputy attorney general may exercise all of the duties of that office. And for the purposes of section 3345 of Title V, the deputy attorney general is the first assistant to the attorney general. That other provision that is referred to has to do with the acting officer provision, which again describes this, the first assistant, who in this case is the deputy attorney general, performing the functions and duties of the office temporarily in an acting capacity. So it's not that the Deputy Attorney General was not involved in this specific appointment. He was also the acting Attorney General. And
he's in a dual role.
Yes, he's in a dual role. So he does actually do the appointment as the acting Attorney General. But at the time, that was one of his duties in his role as a Deputy Attorney General. And the power goes straight through to the executive office, because as the Deputy Attorney General, he was Senate nominated and confirmed. I mean, he was presidentially nominated and confirmed. So all of this checks out when read all together. It's just putting together the pieces that might be a little bit tricky. And I do also want to note, with respect to the separate ultra vires claim that was raised in the opening brief. So the argument was either there's an appointments clause issue. I don't think that exists here. In the alternative that there's an ultra vires issue, I don't think that exists as well, because when the regulation is reviewed in its entirety and also reviewed in concert with those provisions regarding the role of the Deputy Attorney General, all of this checks out completely. But then the last argument being, because it's a constitutional issue, one doesn't have to show prejudice. And that argument was made in the opening brief and then also in the reply brief, and petitioner relies on Bridges. But I want to note, even if the court did view this as the Attorney General violating his own regulations, there's still an exception to that, or at least there has to be a showing of prejudice, especially in the absence of a constitutional violation. And I specifically point the court to Ward v. Holder at 632 F 3rd 395. There, the case involved a question as to whether or not the agency was violating its own regulations in terms of a petitioner looking at his final order of removal and saying, why is there only one board member who signed this under the regulations? I'm interpreting this order as being complicated enough to require a panel of three. And the court requiring not only that the regulation first be found to serve a purpose to benefit the non-citizen, but then also the second part of that analysis requiring that the prejudice interests of the non-citizen protected by the regulation also be demonstrated. And when this circuit developed that test, first in Martinez-Camango, that's at 282 F 3rd 487, the court did consider what petitioner raises in Bridges in terms of, are these rights so fundamental that we can presume a constitutional violation? And the court determined, no, we need to balance that out. Specifically, the court stated in Ward that the analysis adopted in Martinez-Camango endeavors to strike a balance between recognizing the need for administrative agencies to follow their own rules and acknowledging the practical reality that not every agency violation impacts a non-citizen substantive rights. And here, there simply was no allegation of prejudice. So again, even if the court determined that somehow the Attorney General was violating his own regulations, which under the regulatory scheme, he was not, there was no allegation, much less showing of prejudice. So it just, the arguments simply do not work. I have been speaking for a very long time. Does the court have any questions?
Do you have anything to say on the merits argument about how the immigration judge and the board acting through temporary board member Gonzalez handled the merits argument against cancellation of removal here? In other words, the hardship to the children.
Mm-hmm. So I do want to specify that this particular case, although the Seventh Circuit does consider as a mixed question of facts and law, the hardship analysis, that's not raised here. The only thing raised was did the agency actually err in the process of its decision? And The answer to that question is no. I mean, the first part of that challenge involved whether or not the immigration judge was required to specify a completely uncontested fact that occurred twice in the documentary evidence, that occurred twice in testimony, that was never disputed by either party. And the answer is no. There's no case law that specifies that the agency has to lay out findings of fact in a particular way, especially where a fact is entirely uncontested. And particularly in the context of a cancellation of removal case. Petitioner does not point to it. And specifically in one of the cases cited by a petitioner in regarding SH, and that's a 23 INN 462, there is still a recognition that immigration judges have latitude as to how they lay these decisions out. And I do ask the court to think about what petitioner is asking for here, where a fact is completely uncontested, where it comes up multiple times in the record, and again, where it's not even being contested here. We know the children will remain with their mother.
What do you make of the typographical error in the IJ decision? That is, the parties give kind of competing views of how they think it should be interpreted.
So it is acknowledged as a typographical error. And when read in context, the entire paragraph, the special needs analysis checks out. There's a typographical error, but the immigration judge still acknowledges that Wendy has trouble reading. But ultimately, there's no special needs. And the specific language that is given in the parenthetical is that those needs don't rise to the level of requiring an individualized education plan. And I will read that, such as through an individualized education plan. So that's really the basis, that there's no special needs in that regard. This argument was raised below, and the board also looked at it, and in its affirmation of the immigration judge's opinion, relied on that fact, acknowledged the literacy classes that both girls were taking after school, but ultimately the fact on which this relies has to do with, there's no IEP or individualized education plan. That's consistent. And the cases that petitioner relied on in his opening brief and also in the reply brief have to do with either ignoring a swath of evidence. So in Martinez-Baez, it's the exact opposite thing happens. There's an individualized education plan. There's also testimony from an expert that's ignored. This didn't happen here. It just wasn't sufficient to make to rise to the level of hardship. The other argument being that the decisions weren't sufficiently reasoned. They were. We know the reason on which this was decided. There's no IEP, and that remains uncontested. I have reached the end of my time. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you.
Mr. Rubenstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. I'd like to start with Mboba. And at the outset, I don't think that the issuance of an unpublished decision by the Fifth Circuit excuses the government's forfeiture. But even if you look to the Mboba argument, it's flawed on its merits. Under A1, there are 23 board members allowed. That's the maximum number that can be appointed under A1. And if you look at the appointment papers themselves, the recommendation memo from the EOIR director specifies that all 23 of those spots were filled at the time that Mr. Gonzalez was appointed. So he can't be an appointee under A1. And if you look at the regulation as a whole, as both sides encourage you to do, that supports the distinction between the two and supports that A1 can't provide support. The regulation doesn't say A, the Attorney General shall appoint sub 1 board members, sub 4 temporary board members. The Attorney General shall appoint language is all within A1. A4, the parallel provision, not the underneath provision, does not have similar language. Second, as to the Deputy Attorney General, my understanding was that when the Deputy Attorney General is an acting Attorney General, there is also an acting Deputy Attorney General who should have provided approval. To the degree that did not happen here, we think that that is a separate—
What's that based on?
I'm sorry?
What is your argument that there is an acting Attorney general, when there's an acting attorney general, there's also an acting deputy attorney general.
So I believe I don't have that statute cited for you. I had thought that was how it worked. I may be incorrect about that. But in any event, that doesn't cure the problem here. Appointments clause authority can't be delegated. I acknowledge that Myers is a Congress case and the other things are Congress as well. But the whole point of the appointments clause is to vest the appointment authority in the politically accountable people.
I thought we had clarified that this isn't an appointments clause constitutional argument. It's a ultra vires argument.
We're making
two separate things.
We're making both, Your Honor.
I know you're making both, but this issue of compliance with the regulation is just an ultra vires argument, not a constitutional appointments clause argument.
It goes to ultra vires, but it also goes to the constitutional argument because of Muat, which says if you don't have the regulatory authority. So a violation of the regulation is an ultra vires argument. If there's no authority in the regulation to begin with, then that's the appointments clause argument.
But if Mr. Rosen was wearing two hats, acting attorney general and deputy attorney general,
Yes,
he was a busy guy, but he was authorized to do what he did here.
That's the deputy attorney general point is only an ultra vires point. That's correct, Your Honor. As to the cases requiring prejudice, even if you thought it was ultra vires, Accardi shows there's no prejudice requirement. There plainly was no prejudice in Accardi, where the attorney general had ultimate review authority over the decision at issue and had already telegraphed the way he was going to exercise it. Nonetheless, it still had to go back. I see I'm just about out of time. We are happy to submit our briefs on the voluntary departure issue. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have.
All right. Thank you very much. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.